Srinath Mahankali is sitting on a sofa in his family's living room in Queens, New York. He's 12 years old. His father, Srinivas, is looking up dictionary words on a laptop, reading them aloud.
Shami or Shamwa?
Shamwa. May I have the language of Roman, please?
It's Middle French from late Latin.
Shamwa. May I have the definition, please?
A small goat-like antelope.
You've probably figured out by now that Srinath was preparing for a spelling bee. It was the Scripps National Spelling Bee, the Super Bowl of spelling bees.
Shamwa. C-H-A-M-O-I-S. Shamwa.
That's right.
Srinath is not the first great speller in his family. A few years ago, his older brother, Arvind, won the National Spelling Bee and the $30,000 prize. Arvind's winning word? Knadel, from the Yiddish.
Knadel or knadel is a small mass of leavened dough cooked by boiling or steaming, as with soup, stew, or fruit. It's a dumpling.
Knadel. K N A I D E L. Knadel.
Srinath didn't win the Nationals, but still, just to qualify was quite an accomplishment. He got there by winning the New York Daily News competition.
I won on the word osculatory. O-S-C-U-L-A-T-O-R-Y. Do you want to know what it means? Related to kissing.
Srinath practices a lot. And practice, especially what's known as deliberate practice, is vital if you want to get really good at anything. In fact, it may be more important than the talent you're born with.
With the right kind of training, any individual will be able to acquire abilities that were previously viewed as only attainable if you had the right kind of genetic talent.
That's what we talked about on a recent episode of Freakonomics Radio, how deliberate practice can help anyone get really good at just about anything. So, let's assume you buy into that. You really believe that talent is vastly overrated and that with the right amount and the right kind of practice, you can excel. All right, then here's a question. How are you supposed to push yourself to practice like that? Where does that drive come from? How can you increase your determination, your stick-to-itiveness, your, what's the word I'm looking for?
Grit.
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 Grit. Grit.
Yeah, grit. Grit. May I have the definition, please?
I define grit as passion and perseverance for especially long-term goals.
And what kind of questions should we be asking about grit?
What specifically are gritty people like? What do they do when they wake up in the morning? What beliefs do gritty people walk around with in their heads?
And let me ask you this. Can someone who doesn't have a lot of grit learn to get some?
My answer to that would be yes, you can.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Annette Lee grew up in New Jersey. As in many first-generation immigrant Asian families, she says, there was a lot of pressure to succeed, including intrafamilial pressure.
No matter what you did, you always heard about Auntie so-and-so's son or Uncle so-and-so's daughter who did it better, faster, first. So you would come home and say, guess what? I got 1520 on my SATs. And then you would hear, oh, that's too bad. You know, Auntie Rose's son got 1600 and he took them in eighth grade. So pretty much no matter what you did, you were kind of like a disappointment.
Lee's parents both emigrated from China and met in the U.S. in the 1960s. Her mother was studying for an MFA in painting. Her father got his PhD in organic chemistry and took a job at DuPont. They had three kids. Annette was in the middle.
We had a very, I think, middle-class upbringing. You know, like four-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath house in the suburbs. If you've seen The Wonder Years, like that kind of a neighborhood.
In other words, it was kind of average. Average house, average job, and average children. At least that's how her dad saw it, Lee says. He just didn't think his kids had much natural talent. One of his favorite sayings was, "You're no genius."
Yeah, you're no genius. You know, I think that we grew up a lot thinking that we were just failures.
Annette Lee, we should say, became a doctor, a reproductive endocrinologist in private practice in Pennsylvania. But back when she was applying for college and was accepted by Cornell, an Ivy League school, her parents were disappointed that she didn't get into Harvard, Princeton, or Yale.
And my parents' reaction was, "Oh my God, thank God we still have Angie."
Hi, this is Angela.
That is Annette's younger sister, Angie Lee, a.k.a. Angela, now Angela Lee Duckworth. She did go to Harvard and to Oxford, and she got a Ph.D. in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. But their dad's whole genius shtick stayed with her.
I think what my dad meant when he would say out of the blue, you know, "You're no genius," is that I wasn't the smartest person that he had met, that I wasn't leagues smarter than other people my age or people that he knew.
Duckworth's career has worked out pretty well.
I'm scientific director and founder of the Character Lab and a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania.
And now she's written a book.
Oh, yes. Here comes the self-promotion part. I am also author of a book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance.
Duckworth's focus is on education, and her research tries to understand how kids learn best. She used to teach seventh grade math in New York City. In the classroom, watching the successful kids and the unsuccessful ones, she came to the conclusion that a given student's natural abilities seem to matter a lot less than effort and grit.
That's right. I want to redefine genius, if you will. I think most people use the word genius the way my dad means the word genius. You know, somebody who has an intellectual gift, which is far greater than what most people have in a given area, in music or in mathematics, in running or in dancing. And by that natural ability, they're going to far excel the rest of us, almost by destiny. I think that is what most people use the word genius for. And then they all have their handy lists of geniuses that they think of, like Mozart or Einstein. I want to define genius as greatness that isn't necessarily effortless, but in fact, greatness that is earned, however you do earn it. And so I want to define genius as something that you accomplish yourself as opposed to something that's given to you.
And that brings us, I assume, therefore, to grit. So talk about grit. First of all, let's start with how you define it.
I define grit as passion and perseverance for especially long-term goals.
Okay, so that sounds kind of like a no-brainer, that everybody in their right mind would want to have more grit rather than less of that. So surely your argument isn't simply that grit is a good thing to have. It's that grit is what?
So the message of the book is not that grit is a good thing in particular. The message of the book is that, like so many other things about us that are good, we can do something to intentionally cultivate grit in ourselves and in others that we care about.
Well, can you start teaching me right now, or anyone listening to this, how to be grittier? I mean, I want specifics. I want to know what to do. I want to know what not to do. I want to know how long I should expect these changes to take. I want to know if there are going to be relapses that I should be prepared for, and so on. How do we start?
Yeah. When you talk about changing character or changing grit, it feels like, well, you can't change that. It's just people are who they are. But when you actually get to the specifics, you know, what specifically are gritty people like? What do they do when they wake up in the morning? What beliefs do gritty people walk around with in their heads? When you get to that level of specifics, you realize, gosh, there's no reason why these things couldn't be taught, practiced, or learned.
Duckworth has learned what she's learned about grit in two main ways. One, by conducting in-depth interviews with high achievers, business people, athletes, musicians, and so on. Paragons of grit, she calls them. And two, by following groups of people, like new cadets at West Point or students in the Chicago public schools, and seeing whether a person's long-term success corresponds to their grit score. We'll hear later how she calculates that score. Through her research, Duckworth has identified four traits that gritty people have in abundance: interest, practice, purpose, and hope.
let's start with the first thing I think that gritty people develop in the order in which they develop it, which is interest. So one thing that I found about paragons of grit, you know, real outliers in passion and perseverance, is that they have extremely well-developed interests. They cultivate something which grabs their attention initially, but that they become familiar with enough, knowledgeable enough, that they wake up the next day and the next day and the next year, and they're still interested in this thing. And I think that is something that we can actually intentionally decide. I want to be the kind of person who stays interested in something. And so that passion really does have to come first.
What about, however, if I or my kid or someone that I really care about, if I'm a teacher, my students, what if they can't find a passion?
Yeah. I don't know if there are many commencement speeches given these days that don't actually exhort people to follow their passion. And I think that just strikes the fear of God into people, because they then think, oh my God, I don't have one. Now I'm really screwed. And I think the idea of following a passion is just the wrong way to phrase it. Following a passion sounds like it's there in the world, fully formed. You just have to like dig it up under the right bush. Really, you have to foster a passion. You have to actively put some work in and try things and try them for a little while and get into them. And then you have to switch, right? Part of grit is actually doing enough exploration early on, quitting enough things early on that you can find something that you're willing to stick with. So I don't know that there's an easy prescription then for telling people how exactly to do that. But I think one misunderstanding, which is very dangerous, is to suggest to people that passion, it just sort of falls into your lap and it's love at first sight. It's not like that. It's not like that for the people that I've been studying.
And what happens if I'm interested in something to the degree of passionate, but then my passion shifts over time? Do I feel like I'm therefore a loser, that I'm an anti-grittist? You know, I used to think I was passionate, but now I think I'm a dilettante. So how do you handle that?
One of the psychologists that I interviewed said, shame is usually not helpful as an emotion. And I would second that. So no, I don't believe people should berate themselves for deciding that they don't want to go to medical school after all. But I will say this, it is human nature to get bored of things and to seek the novel. And I think that one of the skills that one must develop in life, if one cares not to be a dilettante, if it's a goal of yours to become expert in something, one of the skills is to learn to substitute nuance for novelty.
I love that idea, to substitute nuance for novelty. So rather than constantly moving on to a new thrill, you try to find another level, another dimension of the thing you're already doing to make it more thrilling, whether it's a research project or an arpeggio, a breaststroke, or a souffle, wherever your interests lie.
I think there's something of a skill there that needs to be acquired. Otherwise, we will default to that natural human tendency to click on another hyperlink and go somewhere entirely new.
Okay, so if interest is the first trait that gritty people tend to possess, and you say that is kind of the bedrock foundation, yes, that these are attained in order, yeah?
Yes, that's right. I think developmentally, most people just get interested in something, and then some people cultivate those interests. Those interests get developed and then deepened. And then that second stage is practice.
Particularly deliberate practice.
The kind of deliberate practice that kind of went viral when Malcolm Gladwell wrote Outliers.
In that book, Gladwell popularized what's come to be known as the 10,000-hour rule.
Sometimes it's called the 10-year rule, so-called because the average number of hours of effortful practice was 10,000 hours over 10 years.
But the real guru of deliberate practice is Anders Ericsson, author of the book Peak.
And I'm a professor of psychology at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida.
There are several components to deliberate practice, but generally it's about using good feedback to focus on specific techniques that will lead to real improvement.
So anytime you can focus your performance on improving one aspect, that is the most effective way of improving performance.
Angela Duckworth, in pursuit of a better understanding of grit, has collaborated with Anders Ericsson on research about deliberate practice.
The second stage really does have this quality of laboring in a very methodical way and in a very unfun way for most people to get better and better at this thing that you've become interested in.
And I think that is a conflict that at least I personally, and I know a lot of people that I know, come up against, which is that if you try to force yourself or will yourself into becoming awesome at something that you don't have that true passion for, then the practice does become a sort of slow form of torture as opposed to a kind of work that you're willing to go through because you love the underlying thing, even if you don't love playing that E minor scale for the 1800th time today.
I completely agree. And I think that is why interest must come first. You know, I think there are a lot of overeager, probably very well-intentioned parents out there who are kind of like chaining their kids to the piano bench in hopes that, you know, that seventh hour of practice today is going to, you know, put them on course for Juilliard or Harvard. And I think they're seriously getting things out of order. I interviewed Rowdy Gaines, the 1984 gold medalist in the 100-meter freestyle representing the United States. And, you know, he estimates that in the years up to the Olympics where he won that gold medal, he swam equivalently around the world, right? You know, roughly 20,000 miles. And so I asked him, you know, do you love practice? And he said, are you asking me if I love getting up at 4 in the morning, jumping into a cold pool and swimming laps, looking at a black line on the bottom, you know, at the very edge of my physical ability where my lungs are screaming for oxygen and my arms feel like they're about to fall off? No, I don't. But I love the whole thing. You know, I have a passion for the whole sport. And so that passion really does have to come first.
Such passion plainly comes in many flavors. Olympic competition? Sure. But also spelling.
Okay, the first word is Alamand.
Can I have the definition?
That, again, is 12-year-old Srinath Mahankali and his dad.
A 17th century and 18th century court dance developed in France.
Alamand. A-L-L-E-M-A-N-D. D-E, Alamand.
That's right.
It isn't just the competition that excites Srinath. It's the words themselves.
I have a passion for words because I just don't really understand why they put it together in this sort of way. Like, when they got words from different languages, why did they make it spell this way, that way?
His mother, Bhavani, remembers when her older son, Arvind, caught the spelling bug.
Actually, when my first one was in like third grade or second grade, he was watching Scripps National Spelling Bee on TV. And then he came out with a notebook and he was writing all the words because he wanted to be on TV.
No, Arvind started writing them down, those words, you know, and said, I want to do this and I want to be like that. Because they are small kids. They're so impressed with the small children standing there and asking all the root questions and all that. It was fascinating.
I always thought this is only for some other kids. I'm not going to make my kids do that. I always thought that this is nice to watch, but I'm not expecting...
Beyond our realm, you know.
Srinath, at age 6, was memorizing the winning words at the National Spelling Bee. He learned the diacritical marks in a dictionary that denote pronunciation. His parents wound up coaching him.
I gotta give a lot of thanks to my parents. They look through the dictionary. They look for interesting words. Some of them are too long. Some of them have several different spellings. And some of them are too short.
Instead, Srinath and his parents focus on interesting spellings and patterns, on French and German and Spanish words so we can master foreign prefixes and suffixes in case similar words come up.
Hanap. May I have the language for him, please?
It's from Middle English, from Middle French.
And then he practices and practices and practices, depending, of course, on how much homework he has.
Hanap. H-A-N-A-P. Hanap.
That's correct.
Among the many high achievers that Angela Duckworth has studied are National Spelling Bee contestants. You may not be surprised to learn that high grit scores translate into high spelling scores, and that the style and intensity of practice are extremely important.
Kerry Close, who won the National Spelling Bee one year that we studied it, said the one thing that very grittily studying for the National Spelling Bee for 5 years in a row, because she won her fifth year of competition, was just the ability to take a large something and break it up into little tasks and to fractionate things so they're not so overwhelming and then you can do them. So that is the second stage, and it's about doing things that you can't yet do. And that too, I think people could, if you ask the question, well, do you think kids could learn how to practice in that way? Could adults who really want to pick up something new, could they learn that? I think they can.
If interest comes first, practice follows. What's next?
The third stage is purpose, connecting your work or even your hobby, if that's where your real passion is, to people who are not you. So it's a beyond the self purpose that I'm particularly observing in grit paragons. And I used to think, well, of course that will apply to people who are working on the cure to cancer or people who are working in community organization. But in fact, even athletes, you might say, okay, well, they're doing something kind of selfish, right? They're trying to win the gold medal for themselves. But even these people who have ostensibly very personal, or you could argue selfish interests, they really see how their work is connected to other people. Athletes will say they feel connected to their teammates, to the sport as a whole. So I think that this third stage doesn't happen at the front for most people.
Okay. And the final component of grit is?
The final component is hope. And I won't say that you only need that after you've been doing something for 12 or 15 years. You really do need hope from beginning to end because, of course, no matter where you are in your journey, there are going to be potholes and detours and things that might make you think that it's not worth staying on this path. So hope essentially is the belief that there's something you can do to come back from these problems or from these challenges. And I say it, you know, that it's the fourth component, but it's really something that you need at varying degrees in varying ways all along.
So when you're writing about hope and you link it to optimism and you talk about the difference between optimists and pessimists and you write that optimistic people tend to perform better in school, in their work, that their health is better than pessimistic people. But whenever I see a piece of research like this, I wonder, well, how do we know that the people that are identified as optimists aren't optimistic because they're better off in life? And how do we know that the pessimists aren't pessimistic because they're having a hard time? And that the arrow isn't going in the other direction?
It's a really good question. And I think you're partly right, by the way. Why would somebody be optimistic? I think in part is because they enjoy a virtuous cycle of believing that they can change things, looking for ways that they can improve their situation, putting forth effort, in fact, making some change in their situation for the better, reaping those rewards, and the whole cycle starts over again, right? And you can imagine the vicious cycle for pessimists. And in fact, this is what actually happens, in particular, for example, with clinical depression. When you have at the extreme a pessimistic outlook that says, I'm hopeless. There's nothing that I can do because I'm a loser. I'm not going to go to that party. I'm not going to take that job interview. Okay, well, then what happens? Social isolation, unemployment, that confirms your intuition that everything's awful. You sort of produce the evidence for yourself that you were right all along, which then gets you to be, you know, more entrenched in that pessimistic state. So you're very likely correct that there is a bit of this reverse causality. I would just call it part of this reciprocal causality that reinforces things.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how to measure your own grit score.
So on a scale from 1 to 5, where 5 would be very much like me and 1 would be not at all like me.
Also, how we learn grit early in life.
School forces you to do all sorts of things you hate, like to swim in a really cold pool or to learn French or to write humanities papers about Lord of the Flies.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, Levitt, let me ask you this question. However you think of grit, how would you rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 5 on grittiness?
I am not very gritty when it comes to things I don't like.
That's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt. He's an economist at the University of Chicago.
Almost every day as I watch my kids go to school And I think about how glad I'm not in school anymore, because school forces you to do all sorts of things you hate, like to swim in a really cold pool, or to learn French, or, you know, to write humanities papers about Lord of the Flies, things that I really wouldn't want to have to do. And at this point in my life, I have no grit for things like that. But for things that I have an intrinsic interest in, I am incredibly gritty. I would say I am about the grittiest golfer who's ever walked the planet. I mean, so you and I, you know, we played 72 holes in 2 days. And at the end of those 72 holes, all I wanted to do was go back out to the driving range and the putting green, because I felt like there was so much work to be done.
In the professional realm, meanwhile, Levitt very much subscribes to the passion argument.
One of the things I've always used as an indicator of who will be an excellent economist is the people who love it the most. So even if they don't have a lot of talent, even if they haven't had a lot of good publications, when I talk to people who love economics more than anything else in the world, I know that in 10 years, they're still going to be working as hard as they can to try to get the answers. When I find people who treat it like a job, who don't seem to like it but have a natural talent, I think that's often an indicator of someone who, when the going gets tough, they will not have grit.
But let's back up a minute. How can you tell how gritty somebody actually is? If we're going to try to figure out how important grit is in success, you need to be able to measure their grit, right? These are the kind of questions that are central to Angela Duckworth's research, questions that don't always have complete answers.
Yeah, I'll first say that I wish I knew more as a scientist. And I, in some ways, resisted writing a book because, you know, a scientist is by training, I think, very cautious about overreaching the data. But in my research lab, we do longitudinal studies of individuals at places like West Point or the National Spelling Bee or Chicago Public Schools, places where we can follow people over time in situations that we believe are challenging, and we can measure in some objective way their performance. And we can measure grit at the beginning and their performance at the end. And in many cases, other things like IQ, where we want to make sure that we're controlling for that. So a lot of my research is based on these longitudinal studies, measure their grit, look for differences, high grit people, low grit people, people in the middle, and then see what happens.
To measure grit, Duckworth designed a 12-question survey called the Grit Scale.
I abbreviated it to 10 items in the book because I have discovered through personal experience that people are not very good at dividing by 12 to calculate their score. So, okay. You know, but the origin of this scale were interviews that I had done in my very first years of graduate school when I was trying to understand what the psychological characteristics were of super high achievers. First, I asked them, you know, what they were like, and I learned very quickly that people who are, you know, Nobel laureates or, you know, the equivalent in their field aren't very good at describing themselves, I think in part because we've all been trained to be humble and self-deprecating. So I started asking people about the people that they in turn admired most. And the questions on the scale are almost verbatim the way that these other superachievers were described to me.
Okay. So Angela, would you read a couple of these grit questions from the questionnaire? And I'll go ahead and answer them.
Yeah. So let's start with perseverance. So on a scale from 1 to 5, where 5 would be very much like me and 1 would be not at all like me, setbacks don't discourage me. I don't give up easily.
I would say 4 out of 5. That is mostly like me.
Okay. I finish whatever I begin.
Ooh, well, I'm interpreting that in my brain. I'm going to say not like me at all. I mean, I finish the things that are really important, but there are a lot of things that I don't finish. So I'm going to say not.
So not at all? Like, so 1 out of 5?
Yeah, I'm going to say 1 out of 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am a hard worker.
I would say 4 out of 5. That's mostly like me.
New ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones.
Oh, daily. Yeah, very much like me.
And then my interests change from year to year.
I'd have to say I'm in the middle on that, only because some interests are very, very constant, but then a lot of new ones, and I kill off a lot of old ones. So I guess 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5. Okay, right.
I have a feeling I am like, I'm heading toward like real middle grit territory. I think I'm
yeah,
not
you're
very
good.
Gritty.
You're like,
all right, give me one more. Yeah.
I have been obsessed with a certain idea or project for a short time, but later lost interest.
It's interesting because I want to argue with every one of your questions, because I want to argue like, well, the fact that I've been obsessed with a certain idea or project means that, you know, I have some passion. So doesn't that get me up on the grit scale? But I do lose interest. I would say that's mostly like me. I get obsessions. I follow them for a while. Then I kick them out of bed.
Okay. 1 + 4 = 8, 9. 9 + 3 = 12. 13, 14 divided by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Right? Oh, man. I am
so
ungritty.
You know, not so gritty, right? 2 point something,
2.3.
Right? Between a 2 and a 3.
Yep.
Let's see, I'll turn it over and I'll give you your percentile. Yeah, 10%. I think, you know, you're roughly comparable to 10% of a sample of American adults. There's lots I could say about the danger of making comparisons and error. But, you know, I absolutely agree that sometimes you take these scales and you just want to shout back to them because you know, you don't want to circle the answer. You want to explain why the question itself is flawed. I'd love to hear what your reactions are.
Well, or not necessarily flawed, but that as with any survey in life, it's hard to reduce it to a number or a letter because there are different components of it. In other words, I want to give an essay answer rather than a multiple choice answer, which I know is not the way that surveys can work if you, from your end, you want to use them. But I guess that does get me to the gist of the question, which is, you know, it's a self-reported pile of data. So how good is it?
Yeah, I think I'm quoted in the New York Times saying all measures suck and they all suck in their own way.
This is true. The Times article was about how some California schools are using socio-emotional measures to assess students' performance. Now, you might think that Angela Duckworth, the standard bearer for grit, would be leading this parade too, but you'd be wrong. "I do not think we should be doing this," she told the Times. "It's a bad idea." Just in case anyone missed her point, she wrote an opinion piece for the Times a few weeks later called "Don't Grade Schools on Grit." She argued that the measurement of grit and other character traits may never be good enough for such an important assessment. And she resigned from the board of a nonprofit that was working with the California schools. All this led me to ask her what seems an obvious question. So how can you claim that grit is so important while also claiming that we're not very good yet at measuring grit?
Well, first of all, anything that a social scientist wants to measure, from poverty to self-control to IQ to how well somebody can read, there are no perfect measures. So let's take a questionnaire. They're all fakeable. There are no unfakeable questionnaires. There simply aren't any. And they're also subject to something called reference bias. So, for example, you gave yourself 1 out of 5, the lowest possible score on finishing whatever you begin. Now, I think you made a good point about you don't finish everything. You finish it if you care about. But if you really think about that, I wonder whether if you just compared yourself to the humanity and asked, you know, compared to humanity, are you really in the bottom of the group in terms of finishing things? I doubt that. My guess is that in part, you're comparing yourself to a different standard than other people might be comparing themselves, a very high standard. That's probably in part why you do finish things. So that reference bias is another problem of self-report questionnaires. I don't think that any of the measures that are currently available are appropriate for high stakes accountability policy, like whether a school is doing a good job educating their kids. That's not to say that we can't measure anything at all and we should just throw up our hands and go home. It just means that when we measure things, we should know in what ways our measurements are imperfect. And we should know that any data that we get from these measures is going to carry signal, but also noise.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for just a minute. What if you're just wrong about grit, that it's not as important as you argue? So, for instance, I understand there's a new study by researchers at King's College London suggesting that grit, quote, adds little to the prediction of school achievement, which runs contra to some of your conclusions. They argue that the samples that you've used, spelling bee finalists and teachers, are too selective and therefore, quote, lead to stronger associations between grit and achievement later in life than might be the case in a wider sample. So tell me you're not wrong, or maybe you are wrong and extraordinarily gritty in your ability to admit.
Well, I think it's always important to remind yourself that you could be wrong, right? I know the study that you're talking about, in particular in that study, it's looking at self-reported grit scores as they correlate with your standardized achievement test scores when you're 16 years old. And yes, grit is predictive, but not as predictive as something like a broad scale of conscientiousness.
A broad scale of conscientiousness, meaning the big 5 personality traits that psychologists talk about: extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, openness to experience, and neuroticism. The King's College London study looked at a sample of 4,500 16-year-old twins in Britain.
So a couple of reactions. One is that, you know, I don't expect GRIT to predict all success outcomes equally. I don't think that for many 16-year-olds, their standardized reading and math scores are a goal of personal significance to them. And so that's why I study at places like West Point, like if you're a salesperson, do you stay in your sales job? If you've committed to college, do you finish college? Goals that are at least at some level important to you, and I know that they are. You could say that that's a kind of success outcome. That's not all success outcomes because achievement test scores are another kind of success outcome. But am I wrong? I mean, I guess it would be hard for me to believe. I'll just confess my bias here. It's going to be hard for me to believe that in 20 years, research comes out to say that effort doesn't matter, that the quality and the quantity of your effort doesn't matter, that really the great accomplishments of humankind have been made by people who labored for only minutes or weeks and not for decades, that actually it's possible to get somewhere in life without being hopeful, without learning to practice, without having a sense of meaning, and without being interested in it. So, you know, I could be wrong. It's really hard for me to imagine at that fundamental level that I am.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how to make your kids grittier.
I used to believe that I'm such a hardworking person that my kids will just watch me and that they'll sit down at the piano bench and like start practicing their skills.
Yeah. And advice from someone who has taken self-improvement to the extreme.
I would say interviewing experts, tracking down eccentric weirdos who are really good at one thing or another, formulating a plan for some type of experiment involving their observations or findings, and then recording it. That is what I do most days.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So for parents or would-be parents out there, what are some ideas for instilling grit? Or maybe the better question would be, what are some ideas for not killing the appetite to accomplish grit on their own? Because you do write about how overbearing parents and teachers erode intrinsic motivation. And if motivation is the first step, obviously you don't want to kill that before it can flourish.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a parent to a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old. So after I leave the lab, I sort of come home and there's the study of grit all over again, but just with my own kids and what to do with them. Yeah, so first I do try to remember that though the perseverance piece, the hard work, the kind of get up again after you've fallen down, that's very important. But if I sort of skipped that chapter on them feeling like it's interesting to them and eventually that it's also purposeful to them, that it's important to them and important because it means something to other people, if I skip that, then really I've maybe done more harm than good by trying to get them to now work really hard at it. So I do try to keep that in mind. I also think it's naive to, I used to believe that I'm such a hardworking person that my kids will just watch me and that they'll sit down at the piano bench and like start practicing their skills.
Grit. Yeah.
As my, you know, that's a great idea. I wish that it were so. But I think that even kids who have the potential to be very gritty, they really do need parents to say to them, no, you actually do have to go to track practice today, even though it's raining. Or, you know, and I know that that was not serious practice, right? Let's give it another shot.
That is Angela Duckworth. Impressive, interesting, gritty. By the way, remember how her dad always used to say, you're no genius? Well, in 2013, Duckworth won a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant. Just saying. Up next on Freakonomics Radio, a conversation with someone who is essentially a full-time self-improver. Let's start with, in 60 seconds or less, what you actually do in a given day, if you have such a thing as a given day.
I would say interviewing experts, tracking down eccentric weirdos who are really good at one thing or another, formulating a plan for some type of experiment involving their observations or findings, and then recording it. That is what I do most days.
That is Tim Ferriss. He is... what is he exactly?
I am a human guinea pig and professional dilettante.
He's also the author of books with titles like The 4-Hour Workweek, The 4-Hour Chef, and most recently, Tools of Titans.
Your books are so weird in the best way. They're not narrative from beginning to end. Even when they kind of feel a little bit like those self-help books with boxes and charts, you are just zany in a way that reminds me, I'll be honest with you, of one person more than anyone else, which was my mom. My mom was this kind of Brooklyn girl who ended up in upstate New York trying to be a pioneer woman and raise 8 kids. And she did it. She had to figure out all this stuff. And that's what – that strikes me as what you have this intense – either curiosity or need or something to figure out stuff and then tell other people about it, which is, you know, generous of you. Where does that come from? Why are you not satisfied with just being like everybody else?
I think the answer is twofold. So number one, my mom always encouraged me to march to my own drummer. So that was...
How'd she do that?
She exposed me and my brother, I have one sibling, younger brother, to many, many different environments. My parents didn't have much money growing up, but they always had a budget for books. And my mom would take us to experience things firsthand, like go to the beach and take leftover chicken bones and tie them to strings and fish for crabs, which we threw back. But the list just went on and on. And if we grasped onto anything and became really passionate, then she would, and my father as well, put all their support behind that. And secondly, I think the growing up, I was born premature and I was very, very small until about sixth grade. Small enough to get beat up at recess until sixth grade. I mean, very much the runt of the litter in school. And I was hyperactive. So my mom was looking for a solution to this and threw me into kid wrestling. So a kid wrestling program, weight class based. And I ended up embracing that as my primary sport and got to a national level towards the end of high school. And a big competitive advantage I have was that I studied the science of weight cutting. I got very good at losing weight and then regaining it. I was cutting from, say, 178 pounds to 152 pounds.
Whoa, which is how many classes? Like 4 or 5?
Quite a few, yeah. So I became an amateur scientist in studying the various approaches to weight loss and understanding what I had to do to maintain performance. So using, say, potassium-sparing diuretics even, but something available over the counter, like a dandelion root. And so I think just to provide context for people, that is where I realized the benefits and risks and nuances of experimentation.
You grew up in what many people know as the Hamptons, but not in a lifestyle that was what most people who think of the Hamptons lifestyle, right? You were townie.
That's right. Yeah, right? No white shorts and tennis rackets.
What'd your folks do for a living?
My dad was a real estate broker and local real estate broker. Mom was and still is physical therapist, mm-hmm. focusing on geriatric yeah. patients.
And did you have jobs as a teenager and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. I worked as primarily a busboy at a place called Snowflake, which is now Bostwick's, and then the Lobster Roll. A lot of people know the Lobster Roll, or they might call it lunch, but no locals call it that. It's the Lobster Roll, which is now very well known because of the show The Affair.
Ferriss majored in East Asian studies at Princeton, but he was always looking for business ideas as well. He opened some high-end gyms in Taiwan. He sold audio tapes of college admissions advice. Neither of those worked out. He had better luck teaching speed reading, but he got bored with that. Soon after graduation, he founded a company called Brain Quicken, which sold a nutritional supplement meant to, well, quicken your brain. And then Body Quick, which was pitched to athletes. Ferriss says he was making a lot of money, but he was also badly overworked. So he took a leave of absence, went to Europe. He expected the company to tank in his absence. It didn't. Did even better without him. Which made him wonder if the whole notion of working 40 and 60 and 80 hour weeks might be overrated. So your first book, The 4-Hour Workweek, I am curious because... I don't know, the word I'm looking for is not fraud, but I'm pretty sure you work many more hours than 4 hours per week yourself, right? So was that a prescription? Was it a wish? Or was it a kind of metaphor for what one needs to create?
Well, the objective of the book, for those people who haven't read it, and I'm sure many of the people have not, is to provide you with tools and principles for 10xing your hourly output. And the reason it's gained, I think, a foothold in the finance world with people like hedge fund managers, also with people in the startup world, CEOs of very large, fast-growing companies, is that they are looking for sources of leverage, right, to get more output for each input. The 4-Hour Workweek title was one of 12 titles that I tested on Google AdWords. So I created campaigns to test the respective titles and subtitles and then just looked at the click-through rates, which went to under construction pages. And that performed the best of the options that I had.
What came in second?
Second was...
All right, better question. What was worst? Do you recall the bad
worst,
ones?
The worst, I think, and I had a lot of bad ones, but it was like broadband and white sand or something really cheeseball that. But to talk about my sort of personal perspective, so that's the first context. And the second piece is the book is not about being idle. It's about having control of your non-renewable resource known as time and then applying it how you want to.
But the other kind of misperception of the 4-Hour Workweek is that, especially because it's got a palm tree on the cover, right?
Yeah. The objective is not to stare out into space rubbing cocoa butter on your belly for the rest of your life. It's about optimizing per hour output.
But the real message of the book is the way that we think about filling up our time with, quote, work, which is often less work and more just kind of garbage, is a silly way to think about the world.
I think that a lot of our assumptions are erroneous and misplaced, and that we don't test them very well. So I think part of the reason that the book initially took off in the tech sphere, aside from the fact that I live in Silicon Valley, kind of right in the middle of the switchbox, is that I talked about measurables. It was very much the language of startups. Like, what are your KPIs, your key performance indicators? What are the metrics that you're trying to improve? How do you do an analysis to determine where to focus? And it's very easy, I think, in a digital age, easier than ever to confuse being busy with being productive, and they're just not the same thing.
Right.
And doing something well does not make it important. So we sort of drive towards efficiency and doing things quickly, oftentimes not stopping to assess whether or not the things we're doing are important in the first place.
All right. So, Tim, let's tackle some of our patented frequently asked questions. Feel free to give an expansive answer. Feel free to give a lightning round answer. There's no right or wrong way to do these. Name the handful, or maybe it's more than a handful, of things that you do, whether it's rituals, whether it's diet, sleep, exercise, whatever, things that you do to kind of keep yourself functional and happy and moving forward every day.
Yeah. I wake up probably somewhere between 8:30 and 10 a.m. I tend to stay up late. I sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. Then I brew tea, which is typically pu'er tea with turmeric and ginger added to it, to which I add coconut oil, which is high in medium-chain triglycerides, which the brain likes very much. I consume that as I sit down and journal. There are two different journals that I'm currently using. The 5-minute journal, which was created by a reader of mine, in fact, really, really helpful for setting the tone and focus for the day. And then morning pages, which is really just a free association exercise. Good way to trap your monkey mind on paper so it doesn't distract you and sabotage you for the rest of the day. And between that point and lunch, these days I'm often skipping breakfast. I will focus on hopefully creative production or synthesis. So writing, recording, exploring. And if I have any type of admin or housekeeping metaphorically to deal with, that is done in the afternoon. I'd say that's generally the routine. I every night have a very hot soaking bath. No bubbles, no jets. That's sacrilegious.
What is one thing you own that you should throw out but probably never will?
The wooden shards of the targets that I hit when I was doing the Japanese horseback archery.
Do you have them displayed or just stuffed in a drawer?
They are respectively placed on a shelf, and I have no idea what I'm going to do with them. I think I might
Sounds like you're going
to
keep them.
I might give them away to people at some point. They have such a strong meaning for me. That would definitely be high on the list. I also have notebooks since I just bookshelves and bookshelves of notebooks where I've recorded, for instance, almost all my workouts since I was about 16.
Tim, what is something that you believed for a long time to be true until you found out you were wrong?
I believed for a very long time as an athlete that low fat, high carbohydrate was an optimal
diet. Not
just
you, brother.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's part of the reason that I had so many, and this is speculation on my part, but I think it's a contributing factor to all of the joint problems that I experienced.
What makes you say that?
Starting in high school.
Well, why joints particularly?
I mean, when you're on a moderate protein, low fat, extremely low fat in my case during high school when I was cutting as much weight as I was, diet.
Well, that's also low cal. I mean, you were right.
I wasn't necessarily low calorie. I was consuming a lot of starches and whatnot, which
because
of course
the USDA told you to.
I was following not only the USDA but sports scientists and nutritionists and coaches in the 80s were bodybuilding.
That was the conventional wisdom.
Coaches and whatnot, sure. Really focused on that. And I think there's a decent amount of evidence, circumstantial or direct, to suggest that low-fat diets create a host of issues. I mean, it's I think, entirely unnatural for sedentary people or for athletes.
Small question here. What is the best possible future invention or discovery for humankind?
Best possible. The first thing that comes to mind is functional safety precautions related to artificial intelligence, which I think is very difficult.
Yeah, sure is.
How do you create sort of stopgap ripcords for an intelligence that is, by definition, intended to get to the point where it can do several million hours of human computation in the span of minutes or hours?
So I talk to people about it, I read about it, but it's really hard for me to understand the contours of it. But the catch-22 part, it seems to me, is we want it to be good enough to be so good that we would be secondary. We would be the animals that somehow manage to create a better intelligence and therefore expendable.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
maybe we could be pets.
This is a very, very prevalent and intense conversation among technologists right now. And there are those, of course, who believe that it's summoning the demon and so on. There are those who think it will be a panacea. And there are those who believe it could be both. I tend to fall in that latter group. I mean, I do think that artificial intelligence could solve potentially the greatest dilemmas of our time.
Which you would name as what? The fact that we die too early, the fact that we
space colonization or some variant thereof, climate change, world hunger, warfare or elimination thereof. I mean, it's impossible to conceive of not only the solutions that AI would find to known problems, but the problems it would identify that we haven't even noticed yet.
I have no idea what even the next 5 years will bring, though, in AI, much less 20 years from now. Maybe you do.
I have some guesses, most of which I probably can't talk about, but I would say that
You can't talk about them because you know them to be true?
You've told
someone you won't break the promise?
That's right, the latter. Just proprietary information from companies. But I would say this, imagine that a nuclear bomb were bits and bytes that could be transmitted through any broadband connection.
Meaning replicable and scalable in a way that something physical like that is not.
That's right. That is far more uncontainable than a closely tracked amount of uranium or plutonium.
Mm-hmm. That's a very sobering note on which to end. So let's not end there. All right, last question. If you had a time machine, and it sounds like you may know people who have time machines, when would you travel to and why and what would you do there?
I don't think I would go to the future. I would go... This is the first thing that comes to mind. I would go back in time and have a lot of drinks with Ben Franklin.
You do love Ben Franklin, I know. And there's a lot of reasons to love him, but tell me why him.
Because he wasn't afraid to be an amateur. And as an amateur with beginner's mind, I think, a fresh pair of eyes, he was able to create many, many breakthroughs in multiple fields that have shaped civilization and the world as we know it today. And he was also, though, at the same time, a bit of a merry prankster and a bit of a showman. And I just really enjoy that combination. being able to accomplish very big, serious objectives while not taking yourself too seriously is something I aspire to.
Well done, Tim Ferriss. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.